Welcome to this edition of This Is Design Intelligence, conversations with leadership voices in the built environment. This edition is sponsored by the Tricord Group, leading successful relationship constructs for over 25 years, and VIM, helping the architecture and design disciplines design, deliver, and operate better buildings for a better world.
Greetings, this is Dave Gilmore, and this is Design Intelligence. Joining me in the studio today is Michael Monti. Michael is the Executive Director of the Association of Collegiate Schools of Architecture. Michael, thank you for joining me in the studio today.
Dave, it's great to be here. I appreciate it.
You know, we're looking at the future of higher education. I want to start at that level, and then we'll go from higher education down to, in general higher education. Then we'll go down to design education. And you're in this extraordinary spot where you get to see so much happening around the country, not just defined to the design schools, but in general what's going on with schools around the U.S. given the COVID-19 dynamic and everything where we are. And of course, you and I started having these conversations a few months ago, and boy, have things progressed. It's extraordinary. Any insights about what you're seeing the state of higher education is at this time as we're just about to step into the month of August?
Yeah, flux is not a strong enough word to describe what's happening. Things are changing on a daily basis. Just in the last hour, I was on a phone call with one of my board officers who told me that she had spent a good part of the summer planning for a hybrid in-person and online semester, and the higher-ups in the college decided that they were going to go all online. So all this work that had been done to figure out how to use the building and how to schedule the faculty and get the faculty's predilections for whether they want to teach in person or not, that all got kind of upended. And that's because the pandemic is, as everyone knows, it changes from day to day and week to week. And the conditions that students are facing and faculty and administrators are facing has to adapt to what the reality is.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? The amount of uncertainty on any given day, which has left us almost in a place of fear about whether we make the right or wrong decisions. It really is constraining. And I remember you and I talking about this at the beginning of June, and we were speculating, gosh, you know, by the middle of June, people need to make decisions because they're going to have to pivot. And we went right past that line, and here we are almost in August, and we're still changing and making decisions. And it's extraordinary here in the Atlanta area, even at the public school level, they just bumped out the start date to September now. So we're back a whole month because we can't make a decision, so let's push the start line further back.
Right, and that's happening in the Washington, D.C. area as public school districts or, you know, primary, secondary schools make decisions about what to do with their students. That affects parents and their ability to work. And that in turn affects what's happening at universities. And I got the same message from a university earlier this week that once they learned that the public schools, high schools and elementary schools were going to be all online, that changed the ways in which their parents can participate in higher education. So you learn really quickly how interrelated these things are. And so this uncertainty is it's really unprecedented. It's creating a lot of opportunities for schools. But if you're pivoting on one foot in one month and then switching to the other foot 6 to 8 weeks later, it's hard to actually get a place of purchase where you can take advantage of the opportunities that are in front of you.
Have we ever even thought about the interconnectedness of this? I mean, honestly, we think about little kids going to school. They can't go to school. That means something in the parental structure has to change. That means we don't get to go to work. I happen to be a professor. I can't go to work. And it just click, 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 click right on down like you were explaining. It's unbelievable the interdependencies and the interconnectedness across the economy. Yeah.
Yeah, the word resilience is coming up a lot, and I think people are having to live it out every week.
So the ACSA has really focused in a wonderful way of supporting different colleges and schools in the practice of architecture education across these United States. There are several members, many members of the association. And I'm wondering, so what's it looking like for design education? It's one thing to teach psychology. It's a whole different thing to teach architecture, where there is a very tactile part to the instruction. And how are schools pivoting to address what has never really been done well from a digital standpoint into a digital construct? Ideas of what's working for some folks?
Yep. So we learned a lot really fast from March into June, when everyone had to abruptly turn online. Their students were not necessarily willing participants in online education. But at the same time, there are three or four architecture schools that are fully online, where the students are opting into an all-online model. And some of these have been doing this for 10 to 15 years. And so we've been having webinars with those schools telling their stories about how they do it online. But now we're starting we had a webinar this week where schools were really disclosing what they're planning to do and how they're going to carry out a hybrid model where the students are on campus, but maybe taking their lecture courses online from their dorm room or from a cafe or from sitting on the lawn on campus and then getting together in small groups. So it's really all over the map. The campus setting makes a difference. The climate is going to make a difference, because there's a lot of discussion right now about having classes outside. I should say ACSA isn't just a U.S. association. Full members of ACSA are all the 11 schools in Canada, and it gets cold in Canada pretty soon. So they have to find a different set of solutions compared to the people down in Florida and Arizona who can have classes outside year-round. And so really, in some ways, it really is up to the faculty and the administrators at the architecture school level to decide what works best for them, and to take a look at their schedules, to take a look at what things they have to teach in a given semester, because, you know, especially in the professional degree programs, curricula are very tight. You have sequences of classes that build on each other. And so sometimes you want to delay a class that has a lot of interaction with community members and a lot of work off campus, in person with people. But you can't do that right now the way you can. So you either have to find a digital solution to that, or you decide to push that course to later in the year in hopes that you can get in person with those kinds of constituents. But that's not necessarily easy if you have to satisfy a requirement for graduation and you can't push a course. So every school is different. We always say that in ACSA, but now more than ever, we're really learning, because they have to make really specific choices.
As you know, at Design Intelligence, we deal with the professions quite a bit. And having been with so many firms, I'm regularly asked advice about strategies and where they're going. And one thing that we keep saying is, remain flexible. It's okay to call an audible, as long as your folks know it, that you know, if we have to suddenly turn left, be ready, we're going to turn left, kind of thing. And maybe that's easier to do on the professional side than the practice side. But we are, you know, you enter into these fall semesters and you find out, gee, what we thought was working and it worked in our pilot is not working at scale. We're going to have to make a sharp turn here, or we're going to have to disengage something, or we're going to have to re-engage something. You know, it could be... It's just extraordinary what these folks are having to go through from an administration standpoint.
You're right. One of the things that we learned from surveying our members in the spring is they made a lot of abrupt decisions or quick decisions about policies that apply to students that they had to change in the pivot to online. So a lot of places made grades either pass-fail or pass-fail optional, allowing the students to decide, you know, I'm not able to do my best work, so I don't want to take this course in a way that could ruin my grade point average. At the same time, schools have to revisit the ways in which they assess student work and they assess progress towards a degree. And they all kind of did that as best they could in the spring, reacting to those kinds of circumstances, that's an audible. In the fall now, when you're looking at probably 1 to 2 semesters of online work, you really have to look at institutionalizing those grading policies or things like that. And it really really forces the schools to ask questions about how do you measure excellence? What is expected of students that we just kind of assumed was in place before when everyone was on campus primarily and in the studio on almost a daily basis, and now they're not. So how does design excellence and quality get measured? And I think that's really been something that faculties at each of the schools having conversations about over the summer.
Mm, it's a completely different set of metrics in many cases. It's going to be It honestly opens up the discussion of advantages, doesn't it? You said earlier there's some really positive or upsides to all of this, some advantages to this idea. And I think of digitalization as almost always had advantages across different industries because it's made us more efficient. It's been able to make things more accessible and ready. What can you see as some of the advantages? How can we make lemonade out of these lemons?
Sure. There are lots of opportunities for engagement that schools are taking advantage of digitally that they didn't take the time to do when they had people in person. A great example of this is the final reviews. In asking schools what they did for final semester reviews in the spring, they all had to do them online, and they chose whether it's Zoom or GoToMeeting or so, you know, whatever technology it was for the students to share their work. They concentrated on that. But when they realized we're not bringing experts to campus, we're not having to spend our budget to fly people that are to come in as guest critics for these final reviews, they now were all doing it all online. So they're realizing that they can reconnect with their alumni communities in broader ways. They can have more kinds of critics involved, people that they hadn't connected with, who are too busy to travel back to campus to visit, or for whom you didn't have the funds to fly them from Europe or from Asia to come in and give a critique of your graduating student's work or your sophomore's work. Well, that opportunity was forced on you, and schools really are finding new ways to engage either their alumni or their community partners. Community design, design build projects, those are the things that you can assume are best done in person. But really, once you're forced to rethink what the nature of exchange is or engagement with external people from your university, once you're forced to do it, you can really explore it and you can try to make the best of it. So I would say that alumni connections and connecting with external parties that your university works with are among the opportunities that schools are taking.
Mm, that's fantastic. It really knits the community, the greater community of stakeholders together in a wonderful way. It begs the question of tuition. And how are schools dealing with the idea of tuition when we've often thought of, well, if I go to the school, the tuition is X, but if I'm online, the tuition is Y? Any insights on how tuition is being reconsidered or addressed?
I don't have any data on that. I do remember that there were lawsuits brought against universities by students and entrepreneurial parents of students who are saying, I'm paying for that experience and you're not giving me that experience. Here, it's in the brochure you gave me to recruit me to come to this university. You're not able to deliver on that. I haven't heard that much from schools about changes in tuition. But at the same time, I would say, as of Wednesday night when we did our webinar and asked the 65 people that were there, what's your university doing? 2/3 of those respondents are having students come to class. And so I think from a university's perspective, if you have students coming back to class and you're giving them at least a fair try at that experience, then they're going to charge the same tuition. I haven't heard about all schools that are fully online giving rebates on tuition yet in architecture.
So the fact that we are going to make much of this digital pivot and stay in that context, at least through this first semester, we'll see, God knows what's going to happen in the first, the 2021. It really does lay out an opportunity for this to become a permanent part of education for schools that it never was before, even after we move past this particular pandemic. And, you know, so that begs the question, what does this look like in 24 or 48 months? Do we anticipate that there'll be more digital opportunities for students, or what we might call study from anywhere opportunities?
I think select universities are going to take advantage of that. I think it really depends on the kind of university that you're talking about. You know, ACSA has 145 full members. These are the accredited professional degree programs. And you have universities that think of themselves as global players. They attract a lot of international students. The work that they do is both on their campus, but anywhere around the world. They see themselves in global terms. Well, you're going to see them taking a lot of advantage of the need to be even more online. And so studying from anywhere is going to happen. But then at the same time, there are public universities in states, especially in the United States, that draw their students primarily regionally. And when I talk to them in the spring and asking them, how does your enrollment look in the fall? A lot of them are saying, yeah, our enrollment looks fine. And that's because, one, the university is already priced at competitively. Its value is high because there's low tuition. The students aren't having to fly across the country to go live in a dorm there. They're either commuting from home, or it's easy for them to pick up and leave campus if they need to and go back home. And because they're in the region. And so I see those schools continuing what their mission is, which is as state universities that draw primarily from their region of the country, they're going to continue doing that work. They'll find ways to maybe add students or take advantage of online learning to enrich the courses that they have and to be more flexible. But for them, I think that kind of mission just is intact, and you just kind of add the digital in different ways.
Mm, yeah, fantastic. The question of budgets always comes up because so many of the states who have been hit hard by a tax atrophy because Americans are not outspending like normal, or even up in Canada, the provinces, have had to make decisions about cutting their budgets to schools. And of course, that's like a punch in the gut. I know it's happened harshly to our friends in California, where they've had some significant budget cuts. Any feedback on what's happening there, and how are the schools pivoting to adjust to a shrunk budget to be able to pull this off? Because you almost think you need more budget during a time like this.
Yeah, so I did about 50 interviews in May and June with schools, and I asked them about their budget situation, and the most common response was that they were looking at a 5 to 10% budget cut. I haven't checked with them since then, and we will in September, because we do an annual budget and enrollment survey to check up on both those metrics. I think the thing about these budget cuts is they affect schools in different ways. It doesn't just mean you take a haircut across the board. It really depends on what's cut and what's available. Schools have faculty retiring. They have people changing schools. And you can realize budget, you can kind of make budget cuts work by leaving a line open and switching and hiring a part-time faculty member for the year, or a visiting assistant professor when you were paying a full research line to a senior faculty member who had retired. So schools are going to find ways to close budget gaps as a whole. Now, the bigger problem is when the universities force budget cuts on schools in across the board ways. University of Arizona was public in furloughing faculty members in pretty significant ways. And that was just in May and June. They were already anticipating their loss for that year. And so, you know, it makes you wonder, how do you furlough a faculty member? Do you ask a faculty member to not work, to not read, to not carry out the research that they've started in a lab? So those kinds of furloughs really do hit higher education hard.
Oh, in amazing ways, and can permanently damage a career that's given itself just many years and finds itself just completely incomplete. there's no punctuation at the end, per se. That being the case, let's talk about faculty. I don't think any faculty woke up one day and said, "This is what I'm signing up for. I wanna do education this way." How are we feeling about faculty and their responsiveness in general? Are people pulling together? Is there wholesale rebellion from the tenured world? What are you hearing? What are you feeling about this?
In the first 4 months, and it's really continued now, people are pulling together. You're seeing collaboration like you've not seen before. We have elite private universities partnering with HBCUs on common courses. I heard that one this week. That's HBCUs are historically Black colleges and universities. So this happens at the institutional level. It's happening at the faculty level. Every week from mid-March through the end of June, ACSA had weekly online discussions where people were just sharing what they're doing. And out of that, you're hearing people just sharing what the best technology is or what the best strategy for keeping up engagement in a virtual design studio. And so that level of collaboration and support is really amazing to me. And I guess I chalk that up to the reason that people choose to teach. You choose to teach because of the students. You want what's best for students, and they're seeing the ways in which this pandemic is affecting students. And it's not just, you know, what are your career prospects? Those are kind of the medium and long-term effects. But they're seeing students that are being pushed out of dorms and being forced to go back to homes where it's not easy for them to actually do their best work. They may not have high-speed internet connections. They may be sharing their bedroom with another sibling. They may have elderly people in the household, and they can't risk exposure to get a part-time job. So the ways in which students are in a safe place on campus is really changing that. And there's a lot of empathy among the faculty towards those students. Now, on the other side of this, faculty are concerned about going back in the classroom. We talked about this in our webinar on Wednesday night. There are a lot of places where faculty, especially senior faculty, who are in the at-risk age group in their 50s and 60s and older, and exposure to the coronavirus could be, you know, if you look at at the risk, it's much higher for them. And so this kind of rosy outlook that a university administration might have about bringing students back to campus, when you have to walk that walk as a faculty member and expose yourself, that's a concern. And that's being played out in terms of union negotiations between the administration and the teachers union, and just on a one-to-one level. You got to talk to every faculty member to figure out what they're best set out to do, whether it's teach in person, teach hybrid. Some people are better at technology than others. And so it may not be the best thing to put everyone online when they do their best work in the classroom. And how do you support that?
So as executive director of ACSA, you've been in this for a while. You're so articulate about the space that you're in. You speak with a lot of energy. Tell me, what do you love about your job, Michael?
What I like most about my job is having a broad view about the future of design education. Architectural education is not just about the building. It's about urban environments. It's about interior scales, furniture, technology, human experience. All these aspects, architecture students are being trained to have an impact on, and there are so many opportunities for these students to take the skills of design, both to the design of buildings, but also to cities and to all kinds of places.
That is so great, and what an exciting job, honestly. You're smack in the middle of it. You get to watch the intersection of all these things coming together. Michael Monti, thank you for joining me today on This is Design Intelligence. This is really important to us, and I'm hoping that we'll have you back maybe later in the year as we're in the middle of all of this to see where are we at that point. Thank you again for being with me.
Thanks, Dave. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of This is Design Intelligence, sponsored by the Tricord Group and VIM. The producer for This is Design Intelligence is Laura Spells. Sound engineering by Jared Knabel. This has been a DI Media Group production.